You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, November 20th, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Well, hello, everyone. And on this date in 1984, the SETI Institute was discovered.
Was discovered?
Hey.
Yep.
Where'd they find it?
It was floating around in space or something.
SETI and Forgetti. Cool.
So today's the birthday of SETI.
Birthday of SETI.
What do you guys think of SETI? You think it's a waste of money?
No, I think it's awesome.
No, it's great.
Yeah, I think it's pretty cool.
It's playing the cosmic lottery, but that's one lottery I'd like to play.
Yeah, but it does it correctly. It uses good science.
The payoff it would be incredible. Imagine the payoff.
What do you think would happen globally if we found a legitimate signal?
Panic,
chaos, murder, you know. But hey.
Meltdown, yeah.
Let's roll with it.
The collapse of all worldwide religions.
I think it's worth it.
I think it would make people
more
religious.
Not all the religions, Steve. Yeah, I think that Scientology would probably see an uptick.
You think so?
Honestly,
I think that no one knows. I think until it actually happens,
right.
I think any predictions are probably going to be way off what actually happens. Unforeseen things will occur. All the things that people predicted probably won't occur. You know, it'd be interesting to find out. But
I don't know. So many people believe in aliens, you'd think they'd be like, oh, yeah, I knew that, you know?
It's like, oh, it's about time, yeah.
What do you think the message would be?
Send more Chuck Berry.
That's right, Bob. Not everyone will get that reference.
So we are recording early because we're all going to be eating turkey next week. So we're recording two episodes this week. That's why the delay. This will be coming out in about 9 days.
I wonder what's happened since then.
Yeah, well, yeah. We're behind the times. But luckily, this week there was just a ton of science news. Even though we were doing cramming in two shows in 1 week, there was more stuff to choose from than on most weeks, for whatever reason. The first story we'd like to discuss is one that you blogged about, I think, either today or yesterday, Rebecca, about Kevin Trudeau. So give us the update.
Our favorite charlatan. There's a... I'm gonna steal the headline that Skeptic sent in to us, which is that there was a press release they don't want you to know about. The FTC has given Kevin Trudeau a major smackdown. In case you don't know, Kevin Trudeau is the guy who does the books and the infomercials, all about things they don't want you to know, which has included weight loss and money tips and cancer cures, and it's pretty much all 100% BS. And yeah. So he's finally busted, because what he does is he puts out these books that are full of crap, and then he makes infomercials to promote them, and he just lies nonstop in the infomercial about what's in the book. So, for instance, what he actually got busted on this time was his infomercial for his weight loss book. And he made claims, things like, you can eat whatever you want. Buy my book. It'll teach you how to lose weight. You can still eat whatever you want. And in fact, what the book says is that you have to eat 100% organic foods, and there's all these different restrictions. He also says that you don't need to buy anything except for his book, when in fact you would need to go get injected with human growth hormone and get regular enemas, mm-hmm. right? Colonics.
Yeah. Coffee enemas? Mm.
Oh, boy.
Right. So that's the interesting thing here. So the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, is busting him for essentially false advertising, which is in their purview, not for being a heartless con artist who kills people for money.
Exactly. Yeah. I was surprised when I first saw this that it was for the weight loss book as opposed to the cancer cures they don't want you to know about, mm-hmm. in which he basically tells people who have cancer to give up, you know, treatments that actually work, like chemotherapy, in favor of treatment with, calcium
coral calcium.
Coral calcium, which is just so horrible and damaging that it makes me want to punch him in the face. So, they busted him. It's basically somebody on Skeptic made an apt comparison to it being like tax evasion charges for what's his name?
Al Capone.
You know, Al Capone.
Yeah. Al Capone getting busted for tax evasion.
That's exactly right. Trudeau probably has a bigger list of people that he's killed than Capone or any mobster.
You could be right. I mean, it's impossible to tell.
It's hard to shoot enough people or even order the hits on enough people to equal what you could do by essentially telling millions of people not to take chemotherapy.
Yeah, but you're right. They didn't have an infomercial.
You can't put your finger on a number because it's too difficult. It's not trackable. But
yeah,
you know, just anecdotally, I know people just in my small circle of acquaintances that have bought totally into his BS and have harmed themselves as a result. So if that's any indication, it's got to be pretty widespread.
And also, I get the impression from this guy that he knows he's full of it.
Yeah, that's my impression.
Oh, yeah.
As well.
It's impossible to do what he does without knowing that you're full of it.
He's not a true believer with an ideology. He's just a con artist, in my opinion.
Did he even read the book? Did he even know what was in the book? I mean, he did one where he says that this requires no exercise. But then, of course, if you read the book, it says each phase you need to do for his diet, you need to do 1 hour of walking every day. Well, yeah, you'll lose weight if you work an hour a day. Maybe he didn't even write the book, and he's just kind of just saying, shooting at the hip, trying to say anything to get people just to buy it.
Well, you're assuming he cares about the truth. He clearly doesn't.
No, I don't assume
that.
We
should also mention the guy is a multi-millionaire.
Yeah.
He's incredibly rich from scamming people.
Hopefully not for long, though. I mean, this judgment gave him $5 million fine and then also banned him from doing any more infomercials for 3 years. And of course, I'm sure as soon as the 3 years is up, I mean, he's going to have a whole new cure for something they don't want you to know
about. He'll go to some other country and make infomercials where he's not subject to these laws and penalties.
Yeah, he might ultimately do that. But I think that that judgment is way too light on him. First of all, you have to understand, this isn't the first time he was busted. He was busted for selling fraudulent products on infomercials, and then the FTC had to ban him from selling products on infomercials.
Right.
And then his book of career, that was just a dodge to get around that banning, because now you're not selling products, you're just selling ideas, and that's freedom of speech. So this is his second go around in order to get out of the straitjacket that the FTC tried to put him in the past. Now he couldn't even stay within that, so he had to lie even just selling books. He's lying about what's inside the books, which means the guy's just pathological. So now he's got another slapdown. Honestly, at the level of harm this guy is doing it, the fact that he's in multiple occasions has tried to wiggle out of regulations meant to keep him from hurting the public and from defrauding the public, this guy should be banned from infomercials for life. 3 years. Why give a guy like this 3 years? That's ridiculous. For life. This guy should never have the right to sell anything to anybody again. And $5 million? How about $500 million? How about something on the order of magnitude of the amount of money that he is raking in by scamming and defrauding the public?
And more than fines. He should just be in jail. I mean, I think he should be banned from society.
Yeah.
I think he's that low. And let me just mention quickly that I can't believe I forgot to mention my favorite point against him in this most recent judgment was, in addition to the fact that he says you don't need to exercise, but you do, you can eat whatever you want. No, you can't. He also said in the infomercial that once someone finishes the program in his book, that's when they would be able to eat whatever they want. The FTC noted that it's actually impossible for dieters to complete or finish his four-phase program because his book states that phase four is for the rest of your life.
Oh, God.
That's a good one.
It's important to read the fine print.
Yeah.
Right, right.
But once you're finished that, you can eat whatever you want. You know, once you're finished your life, you just, go nuts.
Not that I need to say this, but that guy is a total douchebag.
He is. Oh, he's far worse. He's far worse than John Edward. He's worse than Sylvia Brown. I mean, he is.
Looks like John Edward.
He's in the top three. You know, yeah. I hope our future robot overlords have special plans for him.
Yes. There was a recent study on acupuncture that caught my interest, and I wrote about this earlier. This was a study of acupuncture in vitro fertilization. So, trying to increase the success rate of, you know, so-called test tube babies or IVF, where you take the sperm and the egg and you mix them together outside the body. That's what in vitro means. And then you implant it in the womb. So often they will put a few fertilized eggs in there, hoping that one will take a hold. And it's very expensive, and success rates, you know, are usually around 35% or so for live births. So anything that could increase the success of this is of course, hugely, even by a little bit, would be hugely valuable. Well, acupuncture, which is, you know, the practice of putting thin needles into specific places in the body, based upon, depending on who you listen to, hundreds or a couple thousand-year-old traditions, based upon, you know, pre-scientific notions that there's this energy flowing through the body, so-called chi, and this is going to rebalance and free up the flow of chi, and you could basically do anything with acupuncture if you believe that. This has been popular in Europe and especially in Asia, using acupuncture for IVF, for in vitro fertilization. Of course, these practices are spreading increasingly to the West, but it's never been proven. There's been like a lot of the acupuncture and alternative medicine applications. There's a lot of crappy studies with mixed results, but acupuncture research has progressed in terms of the technology in a couple of ways. So the studies have progressed to doing what's called sham acupuncture, where you put needles in the wrong place. And when you do that, the chance of getting a positive outcome in these trials decreases significantly. You know, most of those trials are negative, although still some come out with a weak positive signal. But the criticism there is that the acupuncturist knows if they're doing it or not, so it's not double blind. So, and the proponents say, well, how can you do a double blind study of acupuncture? Well, now we're doing double blind studies of acupuncture using an opaque sheath with a dull needle. So the acupuncturist, the needle does not penetrate the skin. So the acupuncturist nor the subject knows if they're getting acupuncture. So it's double blind acupuncture studies.
And you can't tell, I guess, if it's not puncturing the skin.
You can't tell. So since these double-blind studies of acupuncture have done so-called placebo acupuncture, the studies have all been negative. Surprise.
Tighten the controls and
the effect goes away.
Bye-bye effect.
But this study was even more interesting because in this study where they compared acupuncture for IVF to placebo acupuncture, the placebo acupuncture group had a higher success rate than the quote-unquote real acupuncture. This is where it gets interesting. You know, first of all, I'll say that it didn't really have a higher rate, that only if you cherry pick out the one outcome, which was pregnancy by urine testing. But if you go by clinical pregnancies and live births, there was no statistically significant difference.
Wait, what do you mean pregnancy by urine testing? Oh, you just mean
you test the urine.
Finding out you're pregnant.
Right? Yeah,
right. Okay.
Yeah, you get testing
sorry,
to see if it's so they get
you've
a urine test.
As opposed to getting tested like blood test or
yeah, right. That's whatever. Right. But okay. However, with IVF studies, the gold standard is live birth. That's all you care about. Nobody cares if their urine was positive, right? Couples care about whether or not there was a live birth. But or even just how about just did they actually get clinically pregnant? And in this study there was no statistically significant difference between the two groups. So really even to say that the placebo acupuncture did better than the real acupuncture, that is even a little bit of cherry picking and not legitimate. It's essentially random. The results of this study showed it's consistent with the null hypothesis. It doesn't work. It's not doing anything, and you get this sort of random scatter of results between two placebos. Essentially, that's what the data shows. But get this: the people who did the study put out a press release saying that placebo acupuncture may be effective or may be active.
Oh my God.
What?
That's right. In the world of acupuncture and more broadly in the world of so-called alternative medicine, when you have a negative study, that means the placebo is magically active. That was their conclusion. Not that maybe acupuncture doesn't work. you know, for in vitro fertilization.
Wow. Talk about a lose-lose situation for science. It's just ridiculous.
You know, yeah. And ironically, those people are the inspiration for birth control.
But this is not an isolated phenomenon. We've been seeing this a lot. This goes back to Jacques Benveniste and the homeopathy studies where, you know, he said that, the active homeopathic remedies were contaminating the placebo. The placebos that we were using. And so no matter how much they separated them, they couldn't keep the active treatment from contaminating the placebo.
Right.
Or
special pleading?
It was negative. It's just a negative study. Right, dead negative study, and they go all this fancy hand waving to say that the placebo was active.
Those aren't incredible. The conclusions that they wanted. So I mean, come on.
Exactly, that's right. Not good for business to have negative.
That's right.
Studies.
So you know what's happening is that remember. Actually, I can't remember if this actually made the cut onto the show, but I know previously we had this discussion. It may or may not have made it into the show about applied kinesiology and the fact that which is using strength testing to see if someone has an allergy or something like that. And it's complete nonsense. And if you just blind people to the test, like if they don't know if they have a real substance or nothing, so they don't know if they're supposed to be weak or not, then any effect disappears. So blinded studies make the alleged applied kinesiology effect vanish. So one of the researchers said, well, we stopped doing double-blind controls because they all came out negative. Just stopped doing them.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I remember that.
You remember that? But the thing that's really funny is that the homeopaths and the acupuncturists are doing the same thing. But they just got a little bit more savvy with the language. Now what they're saying is we're designing a pragmatic study. You know what a pragmatic study is? No blinding. But they call it pragmatic because they think, well, that's how it's practiced in the real world, not in the artificial, you know, cold environment of a scientific study that's blinded and everything.
Do they know they're no longer doing science at that point?
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that just confirms that they have no idea what the scientific method is for or even what it is.
So, again, it's just all a huge, elaborate justification for using crappy data because the good data doesn't come up with the result that you want.
Crap-based medicine.
It's crap-based medicine.
It is indeed.
Well, we have a couple of NASA updates. The space shuttle Endeavour is in orbit as we speak. And we have a little bit of positive news to talk about and a little bit of negative news. And interestingly, the positive news is that NASA is testing new equipment so that astronauts can drink their own pee.
That's right.
Filtered.
They have to do this, Steve, because, well, for several reasons, but none more important, that the shuttle is going to stop running in a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And they have been supplying water off of the space shuttle and giving it to the International Space Station. But they're going to be doubling their crew from 3 to 6, and the shuttle is going to stop running. And they're not going to be able to get the water up there. So they had to come up with something, a way to reuse whatever they could on the station to make potable water, drinkable water. And that's NASA found a way to do it. They invented a new machine in which is being installed and tested, and they're going to see if it pans out. I guess all the tests on Earth panned out. This new system distills, filters, ionizes, and oxidizes wastewater, including urine, primarily urine, into the fresh water that they are going to drink. And it's going to be about they'll be able to get back 95% of the liquid that's otherwise going to be wasted. Wow.
Well, this is a staple of any, you know, science fiction about colonies or space stations or even spaceships or whatever. You have to recycle all of your resources because you're, you know, going to be off planet for years or maybe indefinitely. So you have to have this sort of self-contained ecosystem where everything is recycled. This was an inevitable development. If we're going to, you know, have moon bases and Mars bases, we're going to need to be able to do this because water, you know, along with oxygen, I mean, that's like the most precious resource. And, you know, water is heavy, you know, costs a lot to lift it into orbit.
A lot.
So being able to reuse 95% of the water in the space station environment is huge.
I read $10,000 per pound. Mm-hmm. Of water.
I'm surprised that they didn't already have a system like this in place.
Yeah, you might think actually when I read that, like, well, they're not already doing that. Yeah,
but had right. But they had to develop one for zero gravity.
Yeah. The Indians drink their pee. That's part of Ayurvedic medicine.
What they need to do is come up with some type of space suit / like still suit from Dune that just recycles everything.
Still
right there.
Suit. Nice.
That's right.
One astronaut had a good quote. He said that we'll make yesterday's coffee into today's coffee. Yeah. I thought that was a funny quote. But it's so psychological, because if you do this process correctly, what you end up with is water that's purer than anything you're drinking right now. Mm-hmm. Purer than anything you're possibly drinking right now. So it's so psychological. It's just funny.
Yeah, I mean, we're basically drinking dinosaur pee at this point, right? I mean, everything is peed out.
But I have a question about that. You know, the water we drink here on Earth is not as pure as it would be after going through that kind of filtration system. I mean, there's, you know, our water that we drink has some things that our body actually needs, like sodium, potassium, chloride, and in some cases, small amounts of fluoride. I guess they'll have to just compensate those minerals in another way, pill form or something. I have no idea.
Or they might just add them back to the water. I know they're adding iodine to the water, and that adds a little bit of an unpleasant flavor to it, according to the
To kill off the microbes that will otherwise develop.
Yeah.
As the great W.C. Fields said, I never drink water. Fish fucking it.
Did he say that?
Yep, he did.
Two fingers.
Two fingers worth. I'll
love
take two
that.
Fingers.
Yeah, that's not a great line for a podcast. But
the astronauts did have an interesting little snafu earlier this week. They lost a bag of tools that apparently was allowed to just drift away from the shuttle. But they vow, this is like every headline, the astronauts vow remaining tool bag won't drift away.
Well, because it's their last one, they better not float away.
It's the biggest thing they've ever lost. On a spacewalk.
Yeah, they've lost screws and screwdrivers and things, but this is a whole bag of tools.
Did they track it? Is it going to come back into the atmosphere, or is it going to stay out there and destroy future spaceships?
It's space debris for now, but you know the shuttle's very low Earth orbit, so it probably won't be up there for too long.
It drifted a couple miles, I thought, as of yesterday. It was about 2.5 miles away, so there's already been a drift. And this tool bag cost $100,000, by the way.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's not like your Sears tool... Right, it's not like you lost a Sears toolkit or something.
Right.
I heard them mention it on the radio this morning. They talked about how expensive it was and everything, and then they immediately mentioned that it was dropped by like the first woman to do this kind of spacewalk or something. I'm just like, oh, come on. Did you have to,
you know, women
point that
tools
out?
Like, I mean, what are you gonna
like,
do?
Stupid chicks.
I heard a recording of her like dropping it, you know what I mean? Or not dropping it, but you know, I heard her like basically say like talk it through and tell them what had happened.
Yeah, she said like, oh great.
I'm never gonna live this down.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
That's all right.
You know, things happen. You know, human error. What are you going to do? It's inevitable. And you know what? Something worse is going to happen in the future. So it'll make people forget about this incident.
It's funny when you think about the, you know, thousands and thousands of scientists who are doing research right now, and none of them have such a focus on them like astronauts do. I mean, everything an astronaut does is immediately broadcast.
Yeah, but
like,
definitely,
it's sexy. It's ridiculously dangerous. You know, it's the most cutting edge visible thing.
Oh, it's frontier. It's definitely fringe.
Yeah, that's a huge amount of pressure. Like, can you imagine, like, just doing your job and you know that it's going to be on the news tonight if you screw something up?
Yeah, we have millions of scientists, you know, walking and driving to work every day, and these people go to work by strapping a rocket to their ass. I mean, there's a big difference.
Well, they're going to hopefully develop little robots and robotic arms and other things that are going to be able to do these things that humans, you know, put themselves in peril and danger having to do now. You know, and they've been testing things like robotic hands and stuff. You control the hands from inside, and it, you know, holding tools, turning things.
Yep. Yeah. Telepresence. Yeah.
So that has a big future in as far as the space program goes.
That gets to the whole, you know, manned versus robotic space exploration debate, which we've had on this show from both sides. But regardless, even if we are committed to people in space, there's still going to be a huge and increasing role for robots for the for a lot of what we do in space, especially all the hazardous stuff.
How cool would it be to have a robotic arm, though? Like, it could be doing stuff while you're asleep. You know, it'd be like...
Such as what, Jim?
What do you mean, attached to you? Or,
yeah, like a real robotic arm. Like, I have one.
So then it would have its own brain, then, you're saying?
Well, no, you could program it before you go to bed. Like, all right, do this, this, and this. You know, you could have, like, a computer there. It could just be typing stuff for you, you know. You could pick up really heavy stuff.
I don't know, Jay.
You could play the Wii and eat a piece of pizza.
Yeah, you could pick up something out of the oven. It won't burn your, you know, you got all your bases covered.
Well, would this robotic arm have different attachments like the guy from Enter the Dragon?
Well, of course. I mean, what would be the point?
Duh. Yeah.
All of Jay's attachments would be masturbatory in nature.
Please, does it even have to be attached? Why can't you remotely control it with a microchip in your brain and just command it from afar?
Yeah, or right. What makes you think that my robotic arm wouldn't need anything to be detached from it? I would just have them all attached at once. It'd be like a wheel of attachments.
Just rotate it.
Like a Swiss Army knife sort of thing?
Yeah.
More like Voltron.
Voltron. Couple more items. The Guardian reports that the Lambeth Council in South London is planning to spend taxpayer money to pay for reflexology for troubled or disobedient students. This is their big plan to deal with students who are violent or who act out.
Yeah, they're spending what, 90,000 pounds on it?
Pounds, yeah, which I understand is real money.
Yeah, that's about what, about 135,000-140,000 American dollars.
180, so usually about twice. 108,000. So reflexology, very quickly, is the notion that the different parts of the body are all represented on the foot, and by, you know, massaging or sometimes really deeply pressing parts of the foot, you can then affect the corresponding part of the body. You know, you can help somebody's liver by pushing on their heel or something.
Yeah, it's a homunculus, man.
Yeah. We spoke about it recently. On
it sounds like an interesting procedure. Having your feet rubbed and pressed sounds good to me.
Yeah, although there's spa reflexology, which we actually reported on that when we were in Las Vegas at TAM, which is meant to be pleasurable. But the quote-unquote real reflexology, or the therapeutic stuff, which requires a different, you know, license, and, you know, they get into their pseudo-medical claims, that's painful. That's not a pleasant experience.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, they jam some tool into your foot with a big...
Or just, like, yeah, stick, it's really hard. So, yeah, by all accounts that I've heard, that's not a pleasant experience. That's painful. But that's not the kind of thing you're going to get if you just go to the spa and they give you a quote-unquote relaxing reflexology massage. That's just marketing. You know, it's basically just calling a foot massage reflexology. But this is, you know, they're thinking of getting, like, you know, the actual reflexologist in there trying to influence, you know, the energy and detoxify the body by squeezing the feet, you know, in changing blood flow or altering nerve impulses. Of course, the homunculus, or this, you know, mapping or representation of the body on the bottom of the foot is all made up. You know, it doesn't exist. It's never been discovered by science. There's no plausible connections or any mechanism that any of this can work. It's just, you know, pre-scientific magic. But that's not stopping this school council from spending taxpayer money on it.
Could you imagine your kids come home from school and they tell you, well, you know, I had a perfect stranger come in and rub my feet today.
Yeah.
I mean, that alone doesn't seem right. And then, you know...
Jay, you got to say an English accent, man.
Oh, father. God.
Yeah, I should have suggested it.
I can't even do it without laughing, though. Father, a man came in and rubbed my feet today.
Both of them.
Now say it as the pedophile from Family Guy.
Oh.
Can I rub your
feet? I'll rub your feet for popsicles. Reflexology. All right. Anyway, that's really creepy. These people sat around and they're like, yeah, we're going to let these people come in and basically massage the kids.
Right.
No, not my kids. If I had kids, no way. No way.
This is the prescription.
Well, let's go on to your email. First one comes from Blake Harbour, and Blake writes, I thoroughly enjoy your blog entries and love the SGU podcast. You have saved me from more than one pseudoscience and have sharpened my mind. I was wondering if you could take a look at an article that gave me pause. Yesterday I was listening to the SGU episode where you interviewed Mark Krislip, who advocated everyone getting the flu shot. Then today I ran into this article, Avoid Flu Shots and Take Vitamin D Instead. Sandwiched between government conspiracy theories and anti-vaccine propaganda, he writes, in one widely quoted study, 1,838 volunteers aged 60 and over were randomized to receive a flu shot or placebo. The flu shot reduced the relative risk of contracting serologically confirmed clinical influenza by a seemingly impressive 50%. The incidence of influenza in the unvaccinated people in the study was 3%. In the vaccinated group, it was 2%. Flu shots reduced the absolute risk of contracting influenza by a meager 1%, not 50% as the relative risk portrays it. And then Blake goes on with a little bit more detail. But the basic question is, so what's the deal with relative risk versus absolute risk? And is this a legitimate criticism? And should everyone get a flu shot? So this is actually a good time of year to talk about this. Actually, they're predicting a nasty flu season, maybe even an early flu season this year. But the good news is they're also predicting that the current crop of flu shots is going to be extremely effective this year. There is some variability in the effectiveness of the flu shot from year to year because they can only guess what strains are going to be prominent. They have to sort of make the vaccines before the flu hits. So they have there a little bit of guessing going on, and they guessed well apparently this year. So they're going to the flu vaccines lining up pretty well with the strains that are cropping up out there in the public. So get your flu shot. Now the bit about relative versus absolute risk, that's true. I mean, then this is actually a way of making tiny effects seem a lot more impressive. And there's no inherent deception. You just have to always know what you're dealing with. If a disease, for example, occurs at an absolute frequency of 2% and that is decreased to 1%, that's a relative risk reduction of 50%. 1 is 50% of 2, but it's an absolute risk reduction of 1%. You know, 2 minus 1 is 1%. So as long as you're stating it accurately, there's no inherent deception there. It's only, you know, when insignificant effects are exaggerated and made to seem significant when they're converted into relative risk. And you may be dealing with something that on absolute levels truly is insignificant. But here's the thing. Even an absolute reduction of just 1 or 2% in the rate of flu is significant because that's still many tens of thousands of people. And considering that some of those people are going to die, that translates into a large number of lives saved. So when the absolute number includes, you know, avoiding death as the outcome, then any reduction is considered a clinically significant or meaningful or beneficial effect. Also, just one last thing is the flu shot can be as effective as 70 to even like 90% effective. So the 50%, that guy was lowballing the number there a little bit. It's anti-vaccine, alternative medicine, propaganda nonsense. The flu vaccine is very effective.
And also, for the record, I mean, when you're talking about how many lives the flu vaccine saves, you should also note that there's no downside to getting the vaccine. It's not like you're going to get sick from it,
right,
or anything. Like, it costs, what, $10 or so, and you could possibly save your own life or the life of someone you come into contact with.
That's right. You know, so even like, you know, younger, healthy people may think, oh, you know, they don't need that. They're not going to die from the flu. Yeah, but your grandmother might die from the flu, and you may be the person that gives it to her. So absolutely. You also get to the herd immunity thing, where if enough people get the flu shot, then it's really going to limit the degree to which it spreads every year. So there's a lot of downstream people that get saved, even be above and beyond just the individual getting vaccinated. And it's extremely safe. It's extremely safe. Of course, you know, we're just all pawns of the big pharma medical industrial complex. So
I'm actually at the bank cashing my check right now.
Yeah, we're just on the payroll. So
from big pharma.
Just doing our job.
Cha-ching.
One more quick email. I don't know if you guys saw this. This just came in today. This comes from Richard Cobbett from England. And he opens up his email with the little brackets, and he says, insert generic love the show bit here.
No, that's not going to do it for us.
Yeah, that's
you're
a little...
We're going to need specifics.
Elaborate.
You know?
Yeah. I don't think
Tell
we have
us.
A generic love the show bit anyway, right? I mean, it's always...
Yeah, they're all pretty different.
It has to be pretty
no,
personal.
I mean, yeah.
You know?
People usually, you know, pick their favorite rogue and go on at length about how much they love her. Or him.
Plus a marriage proposal.
So what about the other part of the email, like the other 99% of it?
Here we go. Not sure if you guys have seen this one, but I couldn't help spotting a certain book in the newly released adventure game A Vampire Story. It's one of the parodies in a library near the start of the game, but it jumped out of the screen. Of course, it could be just a coincidence. I'd hate to rule anything out unless it's too ridiculous to be true. Then, yes. So have you guys seen this picture?
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
I did. I just saw it. It's hilarious.
There is a book on a bookshelf in the library in this video game.
It says, New England Skeptic's Guide to Not-So-Intelligent Design by I. Mary Skeptic.
Right.
That's hilarious.
Honestly, I don't think that could be a coincidence. That's, you know, a New England Skeptic's Guide, and it's, I mean, Not-So-Intelligent Design. That's a title of an article that I wrote that's right on our website, and there's a marriage proposal to Rebecca in the title of the in the author's name of the book.
I'm Mary Skeptic.
I'm Mary Skeptic. I mean, come on.
Oh, my gosh.
That's kind of awesome.
It's a fusion between New England Skeptical Society and the Skeptic's Guide, basically, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who's doubting that the guy didn't do it deliberately?
Well, he just said it could be a coincidence, you know. It's pretty funny.
So, it's a is it a PC game? Vampire Story?
Well, I went to the website, and it looks like it's a kind of a cartoony, but very pretty-looking, like, I guess, role-playing type of game. I didn't have that much time to explore it. I think you download it.
Maybe the person or somebody involved with making this video game, like, listens to the show, and if they did, contact us. Let us know. I'd love to hear the backstory.
Yeah, let us know.
I think it's safe to say that somebody there listens to the show.
Because... Yeah, but what Jay's saying is if you are listening to this show now and you have some information to give us...
Let us know.
That's what I just said.
Right. That's what Jay's saying. Clue us in.
Thank you.
Thanks for thinking of us. It's kind of cool to have our reference in a fake library in a video game. Of course, we all love video games, so that's right down our alley.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's go on to our interview. We are joined now by Stephen Schaffersman. Stephen, welcome to the Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
So Stephen is the president of Texas Citizens for Science, and we have brought him on the podcast this week to talk about the recent brouhaha going on in Texas over the science standards. Can you tell us about what's going on there?
Certainly. Approximately every 10 years, Texas revises its science standards. This year, it's time for science. We did English a few months ago. Before that, it was math, so we're going through them one by one. The problem with this year is that we have language in the current science standards called the strengths and weaknesses language. There's a part, a knowledge and skills requirement in the current standards that requires students to critique the strengths and weaknesses of scientific explanations, including hypotheses and theories, using scientific knowledge. This language was added first to a textbook proclamation in 1988, that's 20 years ago, and then when the first standards came in 1998, the language was added to that, too. I happen to know the history of the language. It was added by creationists on the State Board of Education in order to qualify or help oppose evolution in biology textbooks. Mm-hmm. What happened was there were creationists on the board who wanted to add evidence against evolution or to add some information about creationism, and they were told that it would be illegal to do so. So as a compromise, this language was added so that future people who were opposed to evolution could fight evolution in the biology textbooks by referring to this language, specifically by claiming that the books are required to contain weaknesses of evolution and students must be taught them. So in 1997 and 2003, creationists in Texas and the Discovery Institute came to Austin and tried to get bogus weaknesses of evolution put into the biology textbooks. In 1997, their effort was resisted because it was known that George Bush was going to run for president, and they didn't want any trouble in Texas from the religious right. Mm-hmm. Then, so they convinced them to lay off, and they did. In 2003, however, they went full speed, and it was quite a battle I was involved from the beginning to the end, and we managed to prevail and keep out the bogus weaknesses. Now, of course, we'll talk about what those bogus weaknesses are, but the first thing we should discuss is that the weaknesses are, this is unscientific language. Scientists don't speak of weaknesses in theories. Mm-hmm. Hypotheses have weaknesses, and we, of course, critique hypotheses and investigate them. But scientific theories are composed of tested and corroborated hypotheses, and they don't have weaknesses. They are, of course, incomplete, but I don't consider incompleteness of a theory to be a weakness. I look at theories as strong because they predict new observations, they unify data, and they explain how nature works. So I consider theories strong, and of course, that's the attitude of other scientists, too. So I'm resisting trying to change this. The State Board wants to keep that language. The science panels have taken it out. So there will be a battle in January when it comes time to finally make a decision.
So, yeah, so what you're saying is that this language was deliberately added 20 years ago and then carried through in various forms as a hook. I think you used that term in your blog about this, as a hook for creationists to then slip in their, what they consider to be weaknesses of evolution, of course, but those weaknesses are bogus. It's basically just stuff that creationists make up because they're trying to attack evolution. But it still seems like it's a two-step process. I agree with you that the language is redundant, doesn't need to be there, and is confusing and misleading. If you're teaching science and you're teaching it at an appropriate level and quality, it will include all relevant information. You don't. The legislature doesn't have to say, go out of their way to say, oh, by the way, you have to teach all relevant information. But they still then have to insert their bogus criticisms of evolution or weaknesses of evolution. It's not an automatic that will happen. So they still need to, I guess they would still need to have the school board packed with enough creationists to make that happen. Or is it, I guess what I'm asking is, how easy has it been for them to slip in their bogus criticisms of evolution because this language is in the law?
Okay. Well, that's a good point. It is a two-step process. First, the standards right now are all important because classroom instruction, assessment, and textbooks have to follow the standards. So whatever's in the standards has to be in the textbooks. But then the textbooks will come up for adoption. And they will come up for adoption again in 2010. The last one was 2003. And in 2003, the Discovery Institute came to Texas with their dog and pony show and their carpetbaggers. And they tried to get in their weaknesses of evolution into the biology textbooks then up for adoption using this rule, which is called, we call it Rule 3A. And they failed. They lost by a vote of 11-4. There was quite a struggle. Four members of the state board are young earth creationists, the biblical literalists, and they wanted those weaknesses in. Right now, those four are still on the board, and they've added three more. So we have three, we have seven young earth creationists, biblical literalists, and fundamentalists on the Texas State Board of Education, and they have complete authority to adopt science textbooks, and right now, of course, write science standards. So all they have to do is pick up an 8th vote, and they'll prevail.
Because there's 15 total on the board.
There are 15 total, yes. Yeah. Seven of them are against what they're trying to do. Mm-hmm. And some of those were on the board in 2003. The vote was 11-4, and many of those are still there. And I think they will vote again to support, I'm sure they will all vote again to support the books. But there's only seven of them now. And there is an 8th vote who is the swing vote. And this is an amazing story because this fellow is a Democrat. He's not a biblical literalist, young earth creationist. Mm-hmm. He is a Catholic, Hispanic from San Antonio, and he is the swing voter. And unfortunately, for the past year, he has been voting with the religious right bloc, and that is the problem. So we have to convince him not to vote with them on this issue. You're probably interested in what the Discovery Institute said the weaknesses of evolution were, because they had to come up with some actual examples to stick in the books. Mm-hmm. And the ones they chose were Jonathan Wells' Icons of Evolution,
right?
Which you must be familiar with. These are, of course, examples he calls Icons of Evolution, examples of evolution found in biology textbooks in this country that have false information, incorrect information, or have been superseded by new research, or have errors or have controversies and problems that aren't being taught. And he wrote a whole book about those. And they took those and they said, well, here are the weaknesses in these illustrations of evolution, and these are the ones we want you to put in the textbooks to follow the rule, which, of course, has the strength of law. And there was a mighty debate about this. Over 100 people testified, but the same thing could result in January. In January is where the actual work will take place to adopt the standards. Yesterday was just a discussion and public testimony.
And who are the people who are testifying? Is it mainly scientists trying to testify about what the current scientific evidence is and the accepted theory, or is it mainly like lobbyists from the Discovery Institute and from other places?
Okay, good question. In 2003, the Discovery Institute people came and did testify, and I expect them to be here in January. But yesterday, there were no Discovery Institute people. There were a few creationists, I'd say about 5 or 6 out of the 90, and they testified to keep the strengths and weaknesses language. However, the vast majority of speakers were citizens and scientists who spoke against the language and asked the State Board to remove it. Mm-hmm. And by that I mean to not put it back in, because it has been removed by the science panel. That's the important point. There were many, well, not many, there were several University of Texas at Austin professors, science professors. These guys were brilliant. I often listen to people who testify at State Board hearings, since I have been doing this for over 25 years. And usually I'm not impressed. This time, I was amazed. I thought to myself several times, this fellow really knows what he's talking about, or this woman, because some of the professors were women. There were doctors, biology professors, physics professors, math professors, and these people really knew what they were talking about, and I was just amazed at the quality of their testimony.
Mm-hmm.
I was very gratified. In addition to them, there were science students from the University of Texas at Austin who testified, and these kids were great.
Mm-hmm.
These were biology majors and I think some biology grad students, and they did an excellent job.
Let me ask you a question. I don't want to derail you too much. Let me just ask you a question on that point, because it sounds like what you're saying, you've been doing this for 20-plus years, right? And
yes, yeah.
You were surprised at how the quality of the testimony that was being given on the pro-evolution or pro-science side. And what I think I've observed over time, and what I find, is that this debate has actually raised the level of, I think, expertise and understanding on the part of scientists and evolutionists, so that they have a much greater understanding of how to defend science, how to define it for the public, and what the creationist shenanigans are all about. So inadvertently, I think, I mean, the controversy has actually created a generation of scientists and students who really understand the issues, I think, probably better than they would have if this controversy did not exist. What do you think about that?
Yes, that's an excellent point. I agree with you completely. In years past, people didn't understand what the creationist arguments were, and they spoke past them or didn't understand and didn't really address them. It was totally different yesterday. People understood what the creationists were trying to do, and they answered them perfectly. The creationists have to use very subtle arguments to get their bad material in.
Yeah.
They can't just stick creationism in anymore. It's illegal. People used to say, we don't want creationism in the textbooks. We don't want intelligent design. They're not trying to do that. They know that's illegal. They're trying to undermine or subvert science education by putting in the bogus weaknesses, which they claim are scientific, and requiring them on the basis of academic freedom, so students should know both sides, and because it will improve critical thinking if students learn about the weaknesses and talk about them and debate them. So these are very subtle and malicious arguments that they're using, and frankly, most people just don't understand them, but yesterday people did. I was just so gratified that they were able to express themselves and articulate the true meaning of science and why what the strengths and weaknesses language was trying to do is so bad.
So the creationists are inadvertently evolving better evolution proponents.
Yes, that's true. That's true. 10 years ago, people wouldn't... I was the only one 10 years ago who knew what their arguments were and could address them appropriately. Now, a lot of people can. This is really surprising to me because I used to be the only one who could do it.
Yeah. I wonder how much blogs and podcasts and whatever have contributed to that, because there's so much of a conversation going on online, and it's so easy these days to find a good resource. If you get hit with an argument you haven't heard before, you know, 15 minutes on the internet and you've got all the answers you need. So I think that may
That's
be playing a significant role.
That's true. I've been a student of pseudoscience all my life. Of course, a student of pseudoscience to fight it. I founded the first Houston Skeptics Group. Mm-hmm. I was one of the beginning members of PsyCop and Skeptics Society, and I'm part of the skeptics effort in this country. But I've mainly been fighting my battles in Texas. And for a long time, I would oppose the creationists, and I knew what they were trying to do, and I would oppose them. And I should tell you, I've had nothing but victories over 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
It's really been very nice because I've been able to get resources and the people organized to fight them and to not let them win. We have excellent biology textbooks today filled with evolution, and that wasn't the case in 1980 when I began.
Mm-hmm.
The textbooks were censored. We had disclaimers stamped in the textbooks in Texas. You know about the Alabama disclaimer and the Georgia disclaimer. Texas had anti-evolution disclaimers stamped in books back in the 70s.
Yeah,
and
wow.
I and people for the American Way got them out in the 80s. And I was the first one to oppose them. But now, a lot of evolutionary scientists and mainstream scientists know the arguments and can address them. There were two blogs going on live yesterday. My blog was live, and the Texas Freedom Network, which is an organization that fights the religious right, and this is one of their issues, too, and we often cooperate. One of their communications director was blogging live, too. And both blogs are still there. And it was a lot of fun sitting there typing away while people spoke.
Yeah.
I took pictures, too. I had people's pictures up on the web minutes after they spoke.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. I've noticed a couple of trends, and tell me what you think about this. Reading the Discovery Institute and other sort of ID and creationist propaganda sites, they're definitely hitting the academic freedom theme very, very hard. That is their current strategy, academic freedom. And I also noticed that they're not focusing as exclusively on evolution as they used to. They're shifting, in fact, over to other sort of materialist versus non-materialist questions like consciousness now.
Mind, yeah.
I think because the evolutionary biologists and the scientists in general pretty much have their number on the creationist front. So they're actually trying to find other fronts to fight this same sort of anti-materialism battle that they're fighting. So how much play is the academic freedom thing getting in Texas in general?
Well, that's a good point. As you're aware, they've been very successful with the academic freedom laws that they got passed. They got it passed in Louisiana. They almost got it passed in Florida, Missouri, and several other states. We're going to have legislators trying to pass that law this January. Our legislature meets again in January 2009, and I know that bill will be introduced. It has not yet been introduced, but as soon as it is, I will broadcast the fact. But I'm expecting it. Of course, it's a bogus argument. Students and teachers in high school don't have academic freedom. They're obligated to teach the science standards, and the students are obligated to learn the science standards. Academic freedom is something that's in universities. It protects professors, their research. Now, students, of course, have the right to ask questions, and teachers have the responsibility of answering them honestly and responsibly, but that's not the same as academic freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a word that sounds nice, or a phrase that sounds nice, because it's supposedly freedom is probably guaranteed in some law or the Constitution or something, but basically they're not going to win this way. This is another one of their underhanded, subversive marketing campaign programs. This is what they want to do. They're shrewdly trying to get something that will work, something that will stick. They've tried critical analysis of evolution, teach the weaknesses of evolution. Of course, we used to have balanced treatment and fair play and so forth, and they'll try anything to get their superstitious stuff in. They will try it. This is the first time yesterday I've ever heard the seven radical religious right members on the state board use the term academic freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And I know they got it from the Discovery Institute because they get everything from the Discovery Institute.
Yeah.
Several of them brought up classic creationist arguments, and I mean the most stupid, idiotic creationist arguments, like how will students know about frauds like Piltdown Man unless you have them look at both sides? What about the macroevolution, microevolution problem? I believe in microevolution, but not macroevolution. Students need to learn there's no evidence for macroevolution. Believe it or not, one person brought up polystrate fossils as an argument against evolution, against the time scale. Just unbelievable. These old, old arguments, which have been refuted 100 times, they still are bringing them up because they work. When they're talking to people who don't have any science background, the same as they, because they have no science background,
right,
this kind of stuff works.
That's right. They keep pounding home the same things.
I wanted to jump up and explain polystrate fossils, but the guy they were talking to, unfortunately, didn't answer them very well.
Give us the quickie on polystrate fossils.
Polystrate, yeah. These are fossils that extend through several layers of strata. Mm-hmm. So since a stratum represents a unit of time, how could a fossil extend through several layers of strata, because it would have rotted? You know, these are supposed to be millions of years each, or thousands of years. It would have rotted. How could it extend through these different layers? Well, the fact is that sometimes sedimentation is very rapid. For instance, volcanic mud flows will cover whole forests up to the tops of the trees in a matter of hours. There's many examples like this in the American West, like in Yellowstone. Turbidites will cover fossils. She brought up, the board member brought up the fossil whale extending upright through several layers in the Lompoc quarry in California, which is a Miocene diatomite. See, I was the only one who would know what that is, since I'm a micropaleontologist. And I explained to the fellow who didn't understand what caused it that this was originally an ooze on the seafloor, and the whale died, and it fell to the bottom of the seafloor, and it sunk into the ooze. And later, it was fossilized in an upright position, and it did extend through several layers of diatomite. But that is easily explained if you understand how fossils are preserved.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are cheap arguments that the creationists use in order to undermine science. But if you understand, if you know what they are, you can answer them.
And they're counting on the board members to not understand what it is, and they're trying to just be convincing in their own way.
Right. They're trying to make it seem less certain. And, of course, that's the whole business of the weaknesses. They're not going to be teaching creationism in public schools. They're going to be undermining evolution to make it less certain, to make it seem weak, so that students will lose confidence in science and later turn to the alternative explanation, which, of course, is creationism.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them believe in creationism anyway. At least 50% of all Texas high school students believe in creationism, because that's what they're taught in their schools and their home, their Sunday schools and homes and churches. So it's practically a losing battle even before we start, but that's another story.
So, Steve, if you had to predict now, how do you think this is going to play out? You said that you've been successful over the last 20 years, and it sounds like you're doing great work. And you really shows how just, you know, having one person being vigilant about this can really make a huge difference. But in this current battle over the Texas science standards, does it look like it's going favorably? Do you think it'll work out well?
I'm optimistic. I have to be optimistic in this business. And I think we will get the 8th vote. I think we'll win 8-7. Of course, I'd rather win 11-4, like in 2003, but 8-7 will have to do. There may be compromised language. The science panels did adopt an alternative Rule 3A, which is very well written. It's very scientific. Some board members think in order to get 8 votes, we may have to just revise it a little bit. And in fact, if that happens, it may not be a bad thing. We can certainly write it in a way that will preserve its scientific integrity.
Mm-hmm.
My organization fights to defend scientific accuracy and reliability in education. And I think we can write this several ways that's accurate and reliable, so that scientific integrity is defended.
So, Steve, we appreciate everything you're doing down there on the front lines, and thanks for coming on the show.
You're welcome.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fictitious, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week's items?
So
yes,
ready.
Ready as I'll ever be.
Okay. These were fun this week. Here we go. Number 1, scientists report that they have completed sequencing most of the mammoth genome. Item number 2, a young girl survived without a heart for 4 months while awaiting a transplant. And item number 3, scientists discover a live specimen of a rare New Zealand penguin thought to have gone extinct 500 years ago. Rebecca, I believe it is your turn to go first.
Well, schmack. First of all, I have no idea. I have not read about any of these. Awesome. Second of all, I do remember reading something about mammoths. Like something about them maybe being able to clone mammoths. And maybe to clone one, would you need to sequence the genome? Or maybe it's a part of that research. So I don't know. That might be true. A young girl surviving without a heart for 4 months is kind of crazy. How do you survive without a heart? But, you know, I guess I can see some type of machinery being able to keep her alive. And maybe she's, I don't know how young she is. Maybe she's like a very small baby and, you know, there's not a whole lot of blood to keep pumping. I don't know. And discovering a live specimen of a rare New Zealand penguin thought to have gone extinct 500 years ago. Man, that stuff happens every now and again, like the coelacanth or whatever. So that's plausible too. I'd say that the young girl surviving without a heart is probably the least plausible, but therefore the most likely to be true. So I'm going to go with the rare New Zealand penguin.
Okay.
Because I hate penguins, I guess.
Okay, Jay?
Yeah. Okay, scientists report that they've completed sequencing most of the mammoth genome. Yeah, I totally believe that. I mean, they've found completely whole carcasses. I even remember reading at one point that that some scientists ate meat from a mammoth that they found. My only question about this one would be, was the DNA preserved well enough over the years that, you know, I don't know exactly how many years that they've been extinct, but thousands and thousands of years. And I'm, you know, the only little question I have there is whether or not it would have survived, but I think it would have. The young girl living for 4 months without a heart, the only way I can interpret that is that she was on, you know, a heart machine, which there are people that are on like a full blown heart machine that's just continuously pumping blood through. I don't know about that. I don't know about that one. And then discovering the live specimen of the New Zealand penguin. I love that. I hope that that's true. So I'm going to go with the girl with the heart as the fake.
Okay. Evan?
Yeah, boy, you'd think definitely there's plausibility in all of these. But since we're forced at gunpoint to choose one, my gut is telling...
Metaphorically speaking.
Well, yes, right. Metaphorically. It's not really pointing. I agree with Rebecca. I think the New Zealand penguin one is the fiction.
Okay. Bob?
That's it.
The mammoth genome, yeah. Jay, you were saying how long have they been extinct? It's been thousands of years, but they did find some pygmy mammoths that went extinct, like, geez, what is it, like 4,000 years ago? I mean, really, not that long ago. The other ones were like, I don't know, 10 or 15, I think. So, yeah, I mean, genomes can hang around for that long, especially mammoths were known to being in cold environments. So, yeah, I have no problem with that, sequencing a genome from a mammoth. The girl without a heart, I'm buying that too. We've got machinery that could do that. Obviously, that's an extremely extended amount of time, but I know we have it. I mean, they just had a breakthrough with a new type of Jarvik heart, the portable ones. But the big boys, I'm sure we've got those, and that they for some reason had to do it for so long. Maybe she was pregnant. A young girl. No, I don't know, but I'm buying that one. And then the New Zealand penguin. I didn't see anything about that. A penguin. I don't know. A penguin. Kind of hard to miss in New Zealand, I would think. 500 years. I'm not buying that. I think that is fiction.
A penguin's right. Not difficult to miss. I mean, they all look the same.
I love penguins.
Rebecca, you're just asking for it. All right. Well, you all agree that the mammoth genome has been sequenced. And
yes.
That is indeed science.
Science. So,
yep, they've been working on this for a while, but they reported in Nature this week that they have completed, completed most of the genome. So I had to throw that in there. Otherwise, somebody might have complained. So Yes, they said this was taken from hair samples. I assume that means they had the follicles. That's where the actual cells are that have the DNA in it. This is cool. They got, and they think they've discovered a couple of things. And by the way, it's 10,000 years. So mammoths have been thing for about 10,000 years. So,
but not the pygmy mammoths.
Yeah,
Steve.
So geologically
like
speaking,
3,000 or 4,000 years.
Right. So we just missed them, actually.
Yeah, we did.
Isn't pygmy mammoth an oxymoron?
Yeah, it's like giant shrimp.
Yeah. jumbo shrimp.
Jumbo shrimp, not giant shrimp.
Yeah, giant shrimp.
I'll have 3 giant shrimp, please.
They found a couple of things. First of all, it's the mammoth is much more closely related to the modern-day elephant than previously suspected. So that's cool.
Well, what the hell they expect?
But even more close. I mean, they knew
I
it was
heard
closely,
it's really a bear.
Yeah, they knew it was closely related, but it's even more so.
That, did you know that there used to be 200 separate species of elephants? 200.
I did know that.
And now we've only got like 3.
Yeah.
Stupid elephant.
There's that one with the shovel tusk that's really cool.
Don't send emails because I know there's African elephants and Indian elephants, but they recently discovered that one of those is actually 2 distinct species, so there's actually 3.
The pink elephant.
You can't remember which
extant.
One?
No, I don't remember.
The white elephant in the room.
But what they found was, so it's actually a good thing if you, from the perspective that one of the ways of resurrecting the mammoth is to take elephant DNA and then insert it with those sequences that are different between mammoth and elephant. So if it's closer, that becomes easier because there's fewer changes that you have to make. The other thing that they found, they didn't sequence one intact strand of DNA from a single specimen, right? They get multiple little bits of DNA from multiple specimens, and they sequence those, and they piece them all together like a puzzle. It was actually not that hard to do, using a computer because you have overlapping pieces. The pieces that overlap, there'll be a long string of base pairs that are the same. So they'll fit together pretty obviously. But this also gives them the opportunity to compare the DNA among all the different specimens that they have gotten DNA from. And what they found was that the mammoths were incredibly inbred around 10,000 years ago. There wasn't a lot of diversity, and just the frequency of different alleles follows a pattern that suggests inbreeding, which in turn means that their populations were probably very low. It's therefore no surprise that they were susceptible to going extinct.
I've got here, there's actually 4 elephant species, one more than I thought.
Wow.
4 species
increase.
Of elephant. They're recognized as DNA shows 2 species are different from the Asian and African. All are endangered, but, and then they go into some of that. But so there's 4 separate, 4 distinct species of elephant extant.
All right, well, let's go on to number 2. A young girl survived without a heart for 4 months while awaiting a transplant. And that one is science.
Science.
That one is
wow.
True.
Yay.
Very
Did she
interesting.
Live?
And she lived. She's leaving the hospital. 14-year-old girl. It's an unusual situation. Now, normally you wouldn't keep somebody on on the heart pumps, for that long. So there are artificial heart pumps that you use mainly for surgery. They increase the flow of blood and increase the pressure to help either a failing heart or to bypass the heart during surgery. And they use these artificial heart pumps in a way that's really never been used before and an application that hasn't come up before to keep someone alive for a long period of time. This usually doesn't come up because, there's no situation in which somebody wouldn't have a heart. If you have, a failing heart and you need a transplant, well, you keep your heart until you get the transplant. And if you die before you get the transplant, you die. They don't put you on a heart pump. But what happened with this girl is that she got a transplant, and then within a couple of days, that transplant failed and they had to remove it.
Was it an abnormal?
It was abnormal.
Yeah, but Steve, did they like stitch her back up with the tubes coming out and everything?
Yeah.
Obviously, like they couldn't leave her open.
Yeah, basically, they rigged it so that she could survive for a long period of time. So then they had to keep her going while they got another transplant. So it just was a very unusual situation where they had to keep somebody alive without a heart for a long period of time while they were between two transplants.
Wow.
But it worked. They kept her going for 4 months.
Imagine you're awake, you're conscious, you're in bed, and you're thinking, I have no heart right now.
Yeah.
Holy
scary.
Crap.
So she didn't have a pulse.
Right. It'd be more like a continuous flow. She didn't have any heartbeat, obviously. And, you know, she felt very weird, you know, being in that situation. She said it was really odd to not have a heart, not have a pulse, you know. She felt like she wasn't a whole
wow.
person.
Isn't there something to having a pulse that, you know, our whole system is set up to have a pulse?
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, weren't we just talking about this and about how artificial hearts would pump blood in the same way that a heart does, as opposed to doing a continuous flow?
Yeah, so we were talking about, you know, the newer sort of models of artificial hearts, so they would actually pump, right?
Yeah.
But what difference does it make, continuous flow or pump? I mean, I don't think it would matter that much.
Well, I bet you there are some physiological effects, but they're probably long-term, and we, you know, haven't even begun to gather data on what the long-term effects would be. So all of this means that
Bob was right.
Number three, the...
We all were right, except for
well,
you.
Everyone, except for James. Scientists aww. Discover a live specimen of a rare New Zealand penguin thought to have gone extinct 500 years ago. That one is fiction.
Yeah, you took that off of a real story. Though.
I did, and it's it is the, if you just read the headline, you definitely could have gotten tripped up on this one. Because the headline is, scientists find new penguin extinct for 500 years. And when I first read that, I misinterpreted it. So I actually then made it into what I had it misinterpreted. But what they did find is a penguin new to science. We did not know that this penguin previously existed. But they found the remains, the 500-year-old remains of what they're calling the Waitaha penguin.
And he was a big boy. He was a big boy.
Which went extinct around 1500, about 250.
It makes me uncomfortable when you use that kind of terminology.
Really? Hey, man, if you came up against a 5 or 6 foot penguin, that's a big boy.
Yeah. So they were actually, the naturalists were looking for other penguins in New Zealand that are endangered. There's a species called the yellow-eyed penguin, and that's
an
endangered species. And they were looking for nests of this penguin when they found the bones of a different species that had never been known before and that probably went extinct about 500 years ago. Now, a lot of species went extinct, actually, in Australia and New Zealand when settlers first moved there, partly through direct hunting, although that's, you know, all of the news reports comment only on hunting as a cause for extinction. But in fact, there is evidence, and some people believe that a bigger factor is that wherever humans go, rats follow. And when rats invade an ecosystem, especially like on Australia and New Zealand, there were lots of ground-dwelling birds that nested on the ground. And ground nests were extremely vulnerable to rats because they would, you know, invade the nests for the eggs. Just simple, you know, introduction of other things other than, you know, direct human hunting may have played a bigger role in the extinction of species. And that has actually been played out basically wherever humans go. There's always extinctions in its wake.
Man, we suck.
Yeah. And what's funny is then, like, 500 years later, after we've, you know, killed off a whole bunch of species, the people who become the native people of that part of the world, you know, reach a certain equilibrium with the environment, and then they're looked upon as being, you know, being one with nature and with their environment. But this is already after they've already wreaked, you know, havoc and made a lot of species go extinct.
We're just getting going too. I mean, right now,
yeah,
you know, when scientists look back at this period of time, they'll think, wow. Right. This is we're going through a mass extinction right now.
Yeah, there's right a now. Book called, by Niles Eldridge called The Sixth Extinction, where he writes about the current extinction that's going on. He also writes a lot about these issues that I'm talking about.
That's scary, man.
Basically my source for that information. So good work, guys. That was a good one. I thought I might
thank
get somebody
you.
On the...
well, thank you.
Just reading headlines.
Yep. Too good for you.
I'm on a losing streak.
Are you?
A losing streak of two?
Yeah, that's long.
There's no hot you'll hand, no cold it. Hand, Jay. You know that.
So, Jay, but you may have lost science or fiction. But you do have a quote for us this week, don't you?
Yes, I do. I have a quote that was sent in by Roberta G. Several quotes by very intelligent and beautiful women.
And, beautiful. Okay.
This is a quote by Letitia Elizabeth Landon. She was an English poet and a novelist, born 1802, died 1838, and she wrote, "Whatever people in general do not understand, they are always prepared to dislike. The incomprehensible is always the obnoxious." Letitia Landon!
Good one. That's good.
You know,
that's
she
a good
was better known by her initials, L-E-L.
That's right.
So maybe you should give her a shout-out as L-E-L.
L-E-L!
Speaking of shout-outs, I was interviewed recently for the Skeptic Zone podcast.
The Skeptic Zone!
You were?
Yes. So this cool. is the podcast for Australia for Science and Reason.
Oh, awesome.
Richard Saunders.
This is Richard Saunders, friend. And this is the guys that we know down there. I was interviewed by Dr. Rachie for her Rachie Reports, which is her segment of that podcast. Actually, a pretty long interview. A lot of fun. These guys did a great job. This used to be the Skeptic Tank podcast. Right now, it's the Skeptic Zone, and this is number six.
They didn't like the continued references to poo.
I guess
with the Skeptic Tank. So,
so give it a listen.
Richard Saunders, one of the coolest people that we've connected with because of the skeptical community, and also. Very, very good news that we will definitely be all traveling to Australia in 2010.
Woohoo!
That's right.
And we will be doing one or more public appearances and hoping to meet, you know, a lot of the listeners and just get around Australia. So we're really, really excited about it. And Richard is actually setting the whole thing up for us. And he's really the one making it happen. So we'd like to thank him for it.
He and the other Australian skeptics invited us down very graciously. Very nice. They were very enthusiastic. And so, you know, we had to either just commit or not commit. It's going to take us a couple of years to plan an event like this. So we're definitely going in what is our fall 2010. It'd be like November. And if we're going to fly halfway around the world, we're going to spend a couple weeks there. We'll try to squeeze in as many events as we can. We are going to start asking for our listeners down under to help support this event because it's going to...
We have no shame.
We have no shame. This is going to be a huge drain on our resources to get down there. We're going to do it. We're committed. We'll make it happen. But the more resources we get, i.e. donate money, then the more stuff we'll be able to do when we get down there. Basically.
Resources is code for money.
Resources, right. Jay, who's I know very busy updating the website, is on the donate page, is going to make a separate button to donate for the Skeptic's Guide visit to Australia. We'll say visit down under because we may pop over to New Zealand. We'll see. We'll see what happens. Again, that depends on that whole resource thing.
I'm thinking of bringing some non-indigenous species with me into the country. What do you guys think of that? Think that's a good idea?
I've already stuffed a few rats in my suitcase.
Yeah, I'm going to release some snakes and a couple gerbils and some monkeys maybe. We'll see what happens.
Put a couple of monkeys down your pants.
Don't forget rabbits. They love rabbits there.
I hear Australia is a great proving ground for these kinds of experiments.
I want to squeeze a koala.
Koalas are cute.
Is that what they call that down there?
They got two thumbs.
On each hand?
Does that mean you're all getting mullets, too? I don't know. In my head, Australians are big on mullets.
The novella boys cannot grow facial hair. It's just a fact of biology.
A mullet isn't facial hair.
The other side.
I'm thinking of mutton chops.
Mutton chops.
Mutton chops. Business on top, party in the back.
Yes. Oh, right.
Typically, though, a mullet is accompanied by like short hair everywhere else, though.
So out of style in the States that people laugh now.
I want to meet the Wiggles when I'm down there. Maybe they listen to the show.
The Wiggles?
Well, hot potato, hot potato.
When you raise kids, you have to subject yourself to kiddie entertainment. Some of it's tolerable. Some of it, you want to tear your eyeballs out. The Wiggles actually were tolerable. I actually liked those
guys. Very tolerable.
Yeah, they were.
Really?
They're one of the highest grossing entertainment companies in all of Australia. So
yeah.
They're huge.
Yeah. All right, guys. Thanks, everyone, for joining me again. It's always a pleasure.
You too,
Shirley.
Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkepChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.